Luke chapter 24, verses 1 to 12. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee? The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again." Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. The word of the Lord.
Good morning. Are you happy this morning? Yes? Kind of hard not to be after what we just experienced there. Wonderful time of praise, including original music from our own Kapellmeister. And that wonderful choir, what was that? 2 weeks? 3 weeks? Did that happen? 4 weeks? It's got to be some kind of record there. The four-week choir. Delivering such gorgeous praise for us. Thank you. I'm perplexed because we are celebrating. It's a wonderful celebration we're having. And it would be nice to now have a sermon about spring and joy and happiness and warm weather and feel good things. To go along with it, but this passage does not allow us that luxury. The text here does not supply us with a nice Easter sermon. This text that we just heard is about the resurrection, yes, but it's also about whether the resurrection in fact occurred. You could go to thousands of different places this morning and hear that the real meaning of Easter is that Christ rose in our hearts. It doesn't really matter whether the tomb was empty or full, because his teaching lives on in us who believe. And every time that we do something nice for someone, Christ is risen in us. Hit it, choir. But the text, it doesn't allow us that sermon. And if that is your sentiment this morning in coming here, then I would say to you that you may be an admirer of Jesus Christ, but you have yet to become an experiencer of Jesus Christ. But you may want also a message that says he's alive today. And that may be where we can get to this morning, but if we do, it will be using a different tone of voice when we say it. Because if you want to enter into the experience of the disciples on that first resurrection morning, then you're going to have to live with them through the weekend. And this passage confronts us with the story of that first Easter morning. And instead of bonnets and colored eggs and celebration, this passage is full of struggle and confusion and embarrassment. Because, you know, these disciples are not celebrating. I mean, there was our celebration today might be more appropriate for Pentecost if we're looking at the feelings, the experience of the disciples. That victorious shout that he is risen. But this morning, they're not celebrating, you notice. In fact, they seem to be rather dense about the entire affair. Why do I say that? Because we have disciples in this passage utterly dumbfounded by a sequence of events on which they have been carefully instructed again and again. You know, it's hard for skeptics to believe that Jesus predicted his own death and resurrection beforehand. But there are many things that point to the conclusion that he did. There's the prevalence of this rising again in 3 days thing. It shows up even in the mouth of his accusers at his trial. You know, they're saying something about him saying he would destroy the temple in 3 days and then rebuild it again. He would destroy it and rebuild it again in 3 days, which would have been a preposterous accusation if Jesus hadn't said at least something like that. You know, the power of a lie is in its ability to imitate the truth, some truth. If you think about it, that would have, to say something that like that, that he said that, would have crippled their case. Would damage the credibility of their case if he had, unless Jesus had said something like that. And according to our narrator here, Luke, Jesus, long before his death and resurrection, told his followers explicitly about his death and resurrection. Luke 9:22, he takes him aside, he says, the Son of Man must suffer many things, must be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and he must be killed, and on the third day he must be raised to life. Now, if you notice, our passage is Luke 24. Well, that was Luke 9. And on it goes. Another time he does a miracle. Everybody's amazed. And while they're amazed, while they're marveling, Jesus says to his disciples, takes them aside, he says, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of men. Luke 18:32. Again, he takes the 12, and he says, they'll be handed over to the Gentiles. I'm about to be handed over to the Gentiles. And they will mock me, and they will insult me, they will spit on me, they will flog me, and they will kill me. And then, on the third day, I will rise again. He tells them that. But you know, these are only the explicit times, the times of which we're explicitly informed that Jesus did this. We know that there must have been other times when Jesus taught his disciples about what was going to happen. Luke gives us these to show us the contours of Jesus' teaching on this road to Jerusalem. In other words, these predictions were prevalent in his teaching on the way to Jerusalem. Now, there must have been other times when Jesus talked about it, because these explicit ones are said to be made to the 12 apostles alone. Jesus, in these cases, Jesus takes the 12 alone and he says to them, you know, pay attention to what I'm going to say. This is what's going to happen. But here we come to Easter morning, and these women show up at the tomb, and the angels say to them, notice in verse 6, he says to them, don't you remember what he taught you while he was in Galilee? So the women knew, so all of Jesus' followers were getting this message along the way. The angel is saying, you remember what he told you? Which means, folks, that here, even the women come out looking dense, which is unusual. The women in the Gospels usually come out looking very good, And if you don't think so, you have not been reading your Bible. But not here. Even the women seem unreasonably dull here. In fact, Jesus must have been so upfront about this because even his enemies knew about it. When he was killed, the chief priests and the Pharisees somehow felt compelled to go to Pilate and secure a guard for the tomb. And they say, why? Because, they said, we remember him saying that he will rise again in 3 days. So if even his enemies were familiar with this teaching, his followers must have had a steady diet. Do you see my point? If anyone should have been emotionally and psychologically prepared for this morning, it was these women and men. Why, then, why do we get a story of these disciples coming to Easter morning so psychologically and emotionally unprepared for what occurred? Why are they so dense? But in fact, this is one of the reasons that we can tell that Luke's account is true. Because the reactions that they have are those we would have, but we wouldn't think we would have them until we had lived through it, or something like it. Did you get that? See, you think that you would act differently than the disciples, but you would not. You wouldn't understand, however, that you would react that way. Unless it happened to you. What happened to them? See, the disciples get a bad rap in many sermons. In many sermons that you hear, they come out as dullards or buffoons in some way. But they were not. But they were ordinary people being caught up in this extraordinary story. They were like you and me, sometimes shining. But they reacted in the same way that we do. And if you're feeling like you want to grab these women in verse 8 and shake them, when it says, oh, and then they remembered his words, or grab the disciples in verse 11 when they're, talking about this being nonsense and shake them, or even Peter in verse 12, a little more ambiguous as to Peter, but you want to shake them and say, don't you see, you idiots? It's clear as day. It's right in front of your face. If you want to do that, we have a term for that. It's called self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. Why? The density they have, and I'm claiming that we share, is really the need for a paradigm shift in their thinking. They had to go through a paradigm shift. They had to look at Jesus differently than they had ever done before. You see, the women arrive, and they're at the tomb, and they receive a gentle rebuke. Gentle, but it's a rebuke. Why? Why are you looking for the living among the dead? Why are you doing that? They thought they had come to honor Jesus with their spices. But they were honoring him in the wrong way. It wasn't appropriate because they were looking at Jesus the wrong way. They could not assimilate the teaching that he'd been giving them. And the narrator makes the point. After these predictions, we have Luke saying things like, the disciples didn't understand any of this. Okay? Its meaning was hidden from them. They didn't know what he was talking about. They didn't know what it was meant. They didn't grasp it. And they were afraid to ask him about it. See, they had nowhere to put it. Now the question is, why? And the key to the answer is yourself. You look down on them, possibly, as abnormally dense, because you don't really believe how true this was. And you can't really understand this story until you understand that you might be just as dense. Now, I'm going to try to show that to you. I'm going to try to help you that by helping you see three ways in which you might be like the disciple. Here are the three ingredients of their density. And I'm happy to be able to do this because a friend in the village church recently asked me, he said, do you start out trying to make a three-point sermon, or do you do something else? And I could tell that the question behind the question was, how come our pastor doesn't have 3 points in a sermon like other pastors do? And shouldn't we get 3 points like other churches? Snip, snip. Now, you know, I don't want to mention any names about who might say this, but his initials were E.K. So this is for E.K., whoever that may be. Look, 3 points. Here we go. The three ingredients to density. Okay? Well, so they were dense. First point. They were dense because they wouldn't let Jesus change their expectations. And they were dense, number two, because they were emotionally shredded from unbelief. And number three, they were dense because they needed a reinterpretation of Jesus. Okay? Let's look at these. Number one, they were dense because they wouldn't let Jesus change or challenge their expectations. Now, you've been listening to me for 5 months now here, those of you who are regular attenders here. And I hope that you've been getting the idea that you cannot understand the New Testament without understanding the Old Testament. You really can't. You must live through this people's believing heritage to understand them, to understand their legitimate expectations when Jesus arrives on the scene. These first century citizens of Israel had one thing on their mind if they believed the prophets. And that one thing was the kingdom of heaven, which was the renewal of the kingdom of David, the kingdom on earth that was going to spread and bless the whole earth. And then, if you see that, you can see how Jesus contradicted their, in this case, legitimate expectations, telling them that their kingdom on earth is coming. Yes, it's coming, but it's coming in a way that they weren't expecting. But if they read it right, if they actually read the prophets right and believed them, they would see that what Jesus was talking about was absolutely necessary. See, you cannot have a righteous kingdom that will bless the whole earth unless you take on the problem of unrighteousness. Duh. It's bound up in God's character. And so you must deal with it in the subjects we're going to make up that kingdom. This is what Jesus was trying to get across. And the whole New Testament is about this, the return of this great king. And yet their king turned out to be more a king than they realized. It wasn't the kind of kingship that they could conceive of. King of the Jews, nailed to a criminal's cross, dead. I don't think so. And in fact, the angels here, who are generally pretty authoritative when they show up and say something, they usually just tell you what God's word is or what God's will is. Here, they feel the need to refer back to Jesus' own words himself. You see that in verse 7. He's saying, remember what Jesus told you. They're encouraging the women to reconsider Jesus as the one who is challenging their expectations, who are changing their expectations. Now, I thought about this because I thought that, you know, I've been thinking that we were, well, how am I going to explain this? We're so different from these first century folks. But I've come to think otherwise. I think that some of us are not very different in this regard. That you have certain expectations about how things should go in your life, and Jesus may be contradicting them now. And I want to bring this out because it's in the passage. And I know that Easter is going to be over, and you're going to go back to Monday morning, and you're going to be confronting them again. There may be things in your life that are not going the way you should. And what you have, Christian, under Jesus' lordship, is Jesus contradicting your expectations. Now, how are you responding to that? So before you go calling the disciples dense, you have to ask yourself this question. Are you allowing Jesus to contradict your expectations about how your life should go? And if not, don't you dare think that you would be superior to the disciples in this situation. It's number two. They were dense because they were emotionally shredded from unbelief. They're emotionally shredded from their unbelief. What do I mean by that? You need to understand the feelings that these disciples went through this weekend. Have you ever had someone that you depended on die on you? You ever had someone that you really needed die in your life? Or worse than that, how about not dying? How about walking out on you? How about abandoning you when you felt like you needed them the most? Well, the disciples had this experience and more. See, in verse 11, there's a harshness in that word, nonsense, in that Greek, gleros. It wasn't when the women came and told them, it wasn't just that the disciples said, oh, I have a different opinion, you know, or I don't believe it. It was nonsense to them. They did not want to hear anything about it. Well, what was it? If you walk back through the passage, what was it that Luke says the women told them all these things? Well, what were all these things? If you look at what actually the women had to tell them, wasn't a lot of new information here. So there were these guys at the tomb in dazzling apparel. Well, you know, you don't have to go to Jesus' tomb to see that. Just go to one of Devinder's shows. I mean, I don't know why that would be the real stumbling block here. And so there was the empty tomb, yes. But what was the climax of what they had to tell them? It was the interpretation that they had to report. And what was the interpretation? Again, it was the angel referring back to Jesus' own words. What did they have to say to the apostles except a reminder of what Jesus' own words were to them? But that, they took as nonsense. Now, think about that. Jesus' words are nonsense to the disciples. Why? Because they were bitter, folks. There's a bitterness there. Because they had seen a Jesus who had been in control of every situation he encountered. Whatever the situation, when they had spent 3.5 years with Jesus, whatever situation he came across, he was in control of it. He was master of faith like nobody had ever been before. And they watched him go through these situations. Then they watched him come into this final situation and willingly surrender to the will of the Jewish leaders, who were quite scared of him. Make no mistake of that. Jesus was frightening to these Jewish leaders. And yet, what the disciples saw is Jesus actually submit himself to their will. See, Jesus could have stepped out of this situation at any point. He didn't have to be arrested. I mean, he could have just left at any time. He could have just left. But instead, what do we find? We find him waiting around in the Garden of Gethsemane, apparently long past bedtime, since the disciples, against their will, are falling asleep. What's he doing? He's waiting for them to show up to arrest them. He didn't have to be arrested. And even after he was arrested, he didn't have to get convicted by the high priest, by the Jewish leaders who were bringing this case against him. I mean, you can tell they really had an inept prosecution that couldn't make anything stick. And when he saw that, he sealed the deal with one sentence, which he didn't have to utter, and gave them a reason. And even then, he didn't have to be convicted by Pilate, who was a tyrant, and after it seems he had cut a deal with the Jewish leadership, was now waffling because of his wife, And Jesus again makes the path for Pilate. Didn't have to. These are just natural things he could have done. But at each of these steps, it wasn't so much Jesus as a victim, although he was being victimized. It wasn't so much Jesus as a victim as Jesus making a decision to press on to death. And the disciples saw this, or they saw parts of it. And because they hadn't believed his previous teaching, specifically given to prepare them, what they saw was their needed Messiah, their son of David, throwing in the towel, walking out on them, almost deliberately dying. So they were bitter. And they were in emotional tatters. But they had no right to be. That's what I want you to see. And as the chapter goes on, the rebukes get stronger. You follow out this story if we were to read on. And you must realize, Christian, as you sit and judge these dense apostles, that you are the same. That a lot of your bad feelings regarding your life are consequences of your unbelief. It is sometimes the case that you are emotionally worn down, and it is simply because you will not accept what he has said. There are things that he has said to you in his word that you should not worry about, and you decide that you are going to worry anyway. And so you get into a funk, and you get into these emotionally shredded conditions, and you go through a crucifixion with more than appropriate grief, and get all worn out. But it is a place that you have come to because you have refused to believe the simple words. That's our ingredient to their identity. They're emotionally shredded simply because they hadn't believed him. And number three, they were dense, finally, because they needed a reinterpretation of Jesus. Okay? Now, reconstructions are fun when you go through these accounts. It's fun to compare the different accounts of the resurrection and say, oh, okay, you know, see how different eyewitnesses always are reporting different things. And so one gospel writer says, ah, you know, they went to the tomb while it was still night. Another gospel writer says, oh, they went to the tomb at the first break of day. So you put that together and say, isn't that neat? They started out when it was dark. They probably arrived at the tomb, you know, when it was light. And you get a fuller account of what's going on. But I don't really want to do that here because if we look at Luke's account by himself, you see that what he's reporting to make a point. That the women here and the men needed an interpretation of the event for them to make sense. They needed the angel to give them a profession of what this empty tomb meant. And it involved a paradigm shift about Jesus in their thought about him. See, the passage really gives us two accounts of coming to the tomb. Both of them resulted in this puzzlement, both Peter and the women. And the difference in this passage between Peter and the women is that the women get an interpretation, a reinterpretation of Jesus for them. And by the way, this is another reason that this just really could not have been made up, this account. Because the testimony of women in the first century was widely considered to be completely unreliable. It was just, they weren't admitted in a court of law, and it was just, it's not what you wanted to do to build a credible story if you were trying to do that, to write the account like this. Okay? In fact, you know, we had our worship leader, Alan, made a specific point today of having a woman read to us the passage that we're looking at right now. And he was delighted about this all week, the effect, you know, of having a woman relate to us the story of the women relating the story to the apostles, because the apostles consider it nonsense, and the question is, what are we going to do, right? So you feel this point of irony. Probably went right by you, but Alan was over there, I know, rejoicing at this moment of irony. Okay, you got the irony? Now let's go on. But my point is that, you know, this ain't a way to start a religion. This is not something that could have been made up, because at every retelling, it's not even something that could have grown up as a legend. Because at every retelling in the first century, you'd basically be inviting your audience to consider it a fairy tale. The only reason that Luke related it this way, the only reason he could have, is because that's the way it happened. That the women are the ones giving the report, the interpretation of what happened. But what I'm saying here is that many of us must go through a similar paradigm shift as the women did in their thinking about Jesus Christ. Because you might be here this morning, you might admire him, you might look to him as an example, you might even want to serve him, bring him spices. But you are honoring him in the wrong way. And you cannot experience him unless you first look at him as someone who has served you, as someone who has acted for you. You see, you must connect yourself to the must-be of the angel's words in verse 7. You see that? He must be crucified. Remember he told you he must rise again. Why must? Why all this mustiness in the air? Sorry. Why? For you. Why for you? Yes, he had to be delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification because of our recalcitrance and our unbelief. That's why the must. And becoming a Christian is realizing that it's not bringing your spices that makes things okay with your life and with God. It's crying out, "Wah!" in wonder and acknowledgement at the implication of the empty tomb. That's what it is. And this is what will change you from being an admirer of Jesus Christ to an experiencer of Jesus Christ. What is the proper response to Easter? Is it to get dolled up and to bring our spices to the dead one? Or is it to go, "Wah!" to the one who is alive, as was said earlier, in the here and now, alive still. In fact, let's try that. Let's all of us at the count of three give this correct response. Okay? 1, 2, 3. Wow! Wonderful. There you go. That's Easter. Because the startling point of the empty tomb is that Jesus Christ is alive now. Now. The point of Easter is not that he was once alive, that he's alive and confronting you now, still, now, today. So here we come to this and we can say it. Yes, he's alive. He's alive to contradict your expectations because he promised that he would not forsake you, and he's alive to prove it. Yes, he's alive. He's alive now to relieve you of the burden of your unbelief. Yes, he's alive.